on the internet and call the meeting, the July 29th meeting of the Public Utilities Commission to order. This is the time and place that was noticed for the meeting. I'm Dusty Johnson. Also participating in this meeting are Commissioners Steve Colbeck and Gary Hansen. Our first order of business is the approval of the minutes of the commission meeting held on May 5th. Those minutes have been circulated. Are there any corrections or amendments? Hearing none, any action?
Move for approval.
A motion has been made. At this time, we'll vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. This time, we'll look to Ms. Gregg for an update on the Consumer Affairs Division.
Thank you, Chairman Johnson. The Commission has received a total of 83 contacts since the last report was prepared for the July 14th, 2009 Commission meeting. 24 of the contacts involved telecommunication service, 22 of the contacts involved electric service, 8 contacts involved natural gas service, 2 contacts involved gas and electric service, 1 contact involved a cell phone service, 12 contacts related to the Do Not Call registry, 2 contacts related to the Keystone Pipeline, 3 contacts involved wind energy, and 9 contacts related to issues not regulated by the PUC. And 1,495 of the 1,547 complaints received in 2009 have been resolved. And happy to report that all the complaints in 2008 have been closed.
Thanks, Ms. Gregg. Is there much in the way of commonality for those complaints that on issues that are not regulated by the PUC?
No, they vary a lot. A lot go from water to, basically water and Dish Network, DirecTV, or any issues like that that we don't regulate, but we try to help them and get them to the right agency.
Okay, thanks. Any other questions? Thanks, Ms. Gregg. Before we start the docketed portion, I should mention that my intention is to take the rulemaking last because I think that could take quite a little bit of time. So unless there's an objection by commissioners or parties, we will move those PURPA forms to the end. It may be that in our discussions on ETC that we get into some confidential information. If that's the case, then we'll just need to pause and move those dockets behind the rulemaking. Anyone have any objection? Okay, hearing none, then we'll proceed with electric item number one, EL09-010. This is a filing made by Black Hills Power for approval of tariff revisions. Black Hills Power, your comments.
Thank you, and good morning, Commissioners. This is Chris Kilpatrick on behalf of Black Hills Power. We're here today to update our tariffs to reflect new sample forms. The sample forms relate to billing examples for residential and commercial customers. It's important to note that none of the information has changed. It's really just a reorganization on the bill. We have worked with staff to ensure that they are complete and accurate. And at this point, we would request approval of the new sample forms going to tariffs.
Thank you, Mr. Kilpatrick. Staff.
Thank you, Commissioner Johnson. Staff would recommend approval with an effective date for service on and after August 1st, 2009.
Questions for applicant or staff? Mr. Knadel, I looked at a few of the forms for the other regulated utilities. I mean, it looks like a lot of commonality in these sort of billing forms, but is there anything in particular different or that you'd call our attention to with this as opposed to others?
No, I think they're all pretty well similar. There's a rule that they have to have certain information on the bills. They have complied with that rule. Mm-hmm. So I would say most of them are pretty well similar. They have to follow what information needs to be reflected on the bill as on the rules.
Sure. Other questions? Hearing no further questions, any comments or action?
Motion EL09-010, that the commission approve the tariff revisions.
Might I add on an effective date of August 1st?
Yes.
Great, thanks. Motion has been made by Commissioner Colbeck. Any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Electric item number two does deal with a petition by MidAmerican Energy for approval of a fuel clause rider tariff change. That's the question for the commission today. MidAmerican, your comments.
Good morning, Commissioners. This is Megan Early with MidAmerican.
Mid-American filed a petition for approval to permanently allow the inclusion of hedging costs and benefits associated with specific fuels in our electric energy cost adjustment. Mid-American also responded to 4 data requests from staff regarding this petition. Mid-American consumes a significant amount of fuel during startups and for flame stabilization at our generation facilities. Additionally, Mid-American has exposure to large volume transportation contracts which have fuel adjustment clauses. Fuel prices can be very volatile, and having the ability to hedge a portion of anticipated fuel needs can significantly reduce price volatility for our customers. On the phone from Mid-American are those who contributed technical and or legal expertise to the petition and the data request responses. They are Rich Singer, Brian Weiss, Diane Knoll, Susan Stewart, and they are available to answer any questions you may have.
Thanks, Ms. Early. Staff?
Yes, thank you, Commissioner. This is Bob Canale. I did check with Mid-American to see if they had this proposal before any other commissioner approved before Illinois and Iowa, but they do not have a fuel adjustment charge in those states at this point in time. And so the dollar amount for South Dakota, we have about 1% of their business, so the dollar amount that's been would be reflected in here wouldn't be very substantial at this point in time. So I do have a recommendation, unless you'd want to entertain questions first, I guess.
Why don't you go ahead and share your recommendation?
I would recommend approval of the filing subject to the following conditions: that the proposed changes in the fuel adjustment clause are effective on and after August 1st, 2009, and that the company credit the fuel adjustment clause with amounts already reflected in prior monthly fuel adjustment clause filings and recovered from customers. That Mid-American shall submit an annual report as outlined in pages 5 and 6 of the filing, and also include a cost-benefit analysis. That Mid-American shall follow its risk management policy, and that the Commission retains the ability to terminate Mid-American's authority to pass through cost associated with the filing at any time, provided it gives Mid-American at least a 3-month notice.
Okay, so if memory serves, Mr. Canale, the company asked for retroactivity back to February?
February 1st, that's correct, and they estimate the amounts approximately $350-some, the South Dakota portion.
Okay, first off, either for the applicant or for staff, that's a very small amount. Of course, I mean, give me an idea of what that looks like. What's the impact on a typical residential consumer?
It's going to be fairly small. They probably have approximately 4,000 customers. The way I look at it, I guess, is I'm not looking at the dollar amount. I'm looking at the precedent it may set by going back to the February 1st date. And that's the reason my recommendation, that it should be prospective only.
Well, and I tend to agree that it would be I wouldn't want to set a precedent. I wonder about such a de minimis amount and what if that creates some burden on the applicant with regard to accounting. So maybe let's pause and hear from an American. If staff's recommendation was adopted, does that create a burden for Mid-American?
This is Diane Knoll with Mid-American Energy Company, and we have the dollar amount calculated. We can certainly credit it back. On the other hand, it is a very small amount. It will require a small amount of additional accounting and work, but Mid-American would be agreeable to whatever you recommend.
So if it's a small amount of extra work, why had Mid-American requested the retroactivity?
I think that we had asked to include it only because it was our intention to include it in the future, and it may not have been realized that the small amount had gone through because of the way that this type of fuel is accounted for. It is posted to an inventory account and then later expensed as used, which is why it's such a de minimis amount. $11,000 was added to inventory, but then only $300 over 3 months was actually expensed, which is why we hadn't caught it. And once we realized that we had been hedging these fuels back to February, our intention was to just include it from when we began doing it going forward once we realized that it was included in the fuel clause.
Thanks very much.
Mr. Chairman Johnson, I'd like to add one other thing. If you do entertain the idea going back to February 1st, the $350 is related to the fuel, and they would also be requesting natural gas amounts that was previously removed. And I don't know what that amount is, but, you know, if you do go back retroactively, I believe their filing indicates that they'd want to include those natural gas amounts that were previously excluded from the fuel adjustment charge.
Okay, tell me more about that, Mr. Knadel, these natural gas charges that were previously removed.
Well, they removed those instead of running through the fuel adjustment subject to this filing here, and it was harder to remove the fuel oil amounts, and that's why that was included in your inventory.
This is Diane Noel again with MidAmerican, and I do have the dollar amount of gas hedging that we have excluded from South Dakota ECA, and the South Dakota portion was $79.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Knadel, putting aside the retroactive issue and just focusing on the moving forward issue, is this similar to how hedging practices with regard to electricity are handled for the other five electric providers and regulated electric providers in South Dakota?
I believe in the past the commission did approve a similar program for XL Energy, and I believe that was in 1999 or 2000, and then it had an annual reporting to basically, they had to approve that on a year-by-year basis. And XL did get that approved for, I think, 2 or 3 years. And then they quit doing that. So I'm not aware of any other electric utility that has this in their fuel adjustment charge at this time.
So for those that aren't receiving recovery through the fuel adjustment charge, I mean, are those costs, you know, were those set during a historic test year and so, you know, are part of the base rates, or are those costs that are not recovered from ratepayers at all?
They're more than likely not recovered for ratepayers at all, because those costs should be flowed through the fuel adjustment charge.
Okay. You talk about in your recommendation a cost-benefit analysis. Hedging reduces volatility, but certainly not price, at least in the long run. How do we assess a benefit to reduced volatility? But clearly there is one. I just don't know how economically you assign it.
Well, there could be a cost or a benefit depending on the dollar amount or what price the hedge at versus what the price is at the time they do the option for the hedge. I mean, it could go up. It could go down. But, you know, the expectation is that it's going to be an annual benefit. If you look at it at one point in time, it may be a cost to the company or to the customers. But when you look at it over a year's time, you know, the hope is that it's going to be a benefit to the customer.
So that cost-benefit analysis is, I mean, the results of that are going to be pretty obvious to us, presumably in any given year. I mean, if natural gas ends up being significantly less expensive than people would have guessed, then it would have been the cost-benefit analysis would be negative. I mean, the company would have hedged some supply of gas. Prices would have dropped. Consumers, at least in that season, in that year, didn't benefit. I mean, they received reduced volatility, but not on the price perspective, they ended up in the wrong area.
That's correct. I mean, this is a similar program that they have in, you know, for natural gas. Mid-American comes in each year and, you know, gives us a report on their hedging activities for natural gas and, you know, the cost benefit of that also.
So walk us through one more time, sort of line by line, your recommendations. There was a cost-benefit analysis, an annual report that is listed on page 5 and 6 of the filing. There was an effective date of August 1st. What else?
On that, the company credit the fuel adjustment clause with the amounts already reflected in prior monthly fuel adjustment clause filings and recovered from customers. That was an amount of approximately $300 to $400. That Mid-American shall follow its risk management policy, and that the commission retains the ability to terminate Mid-American's authority to pass through costs associated with the filing at any time, provided it gives Mid-American at least a 3-month notice. that's when we'll file their annual report. At that point in time, we'll see if it's, you know, a benefit to the customer or cost to the customer.
Okay. Thanks, MidAmerican. Any comments on the staff recommended action?
We are agreeable to accept those.
Okay. Thanks. Other commissioner questions or comments?
Mr. Chairman, if I may, this is Commissioner Hansen.
Yeah.
I'm curious. The 351.21 for approximately $88 a month, that's attributable to South Dakota. Obviously, if that's spread over 4,000 customers, that's a pretty small amount. But I'm curious about the – and well, first of all, is it 4,000 customers? And secondly, is that representative of a typical year? I heard the number 11,000, and so I'm curious if we're just looking at this from a standpoint of a lean year for cost, and if it's going to be, if you would judge it to be more than that in future years.
This is Rich Singer at MidAmerican Energy, and as part of a response to a data request, I think it was data request number two, we looked back over the last 3 years and looked at the current hedges that we had in place and then took the bounds of the last 3 years to sort of quantify the potential loss and potential gain that we could see. And in general, for the heating oil in 2009, we were looking at a potential benefit to South Dakota of around $27,000. To a cost of about $4,000, that's on an annual basis. And then for natural gas, we were looking at a benefit of $5,000 to a loss of $1,700. So not a large number of dollars here.
But certainly different numbers than 351 that we're looking at. But thank you very much. Appreciate that. And a question for staff. From what I understand, we've set precedent to an extent on this type of a docket previously where we have said yes. I don't necessarily feel totally obliged to follow precedent all the time, depending on the nuances of a docket, but is that accurate? Have we said yes to other companies, and do you have somewhat of a history on that for us?
I believe the only one I'm aware of is XL Energy, and I think it was 1999.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, other questions? Any comments? Yes, Mr. Isloff.
A couple things. Number one, it seems to me that even though you may be concerned about precedent, I don't know if it's necessary to look at these things as precedent or to treat each one as an individual transaction, an individual docket before the commission, as we're in somewhat unique territory right now. I don't know if the 351 going back really makes any difference at all. As far as the annual update, I understand that, but the problem I have with that is that either you adopt a hedging program and you live with it, and I think it's important to review to see if there's ongoing benefit, but there's a chance you can get a year where you may not benefit from that hedge. But overall, is it a good policy to stay with that hedge program? And, you know, I have some concerns. It seems to me that once staff has come before the commission and approved a hedging and asked for approval of a hedging program or at least put their stamp on it, that, you know, it doesn't hurt the company to come in at the end of the year and let us know how it turned out, but it doesn't mean just because you have one bad year that you necessarily want to throw that program out. I don't know if review necessarily is an indicator of whether or not the program should continue.
Other questions or comments? Any action? Well, I actually have just one more question. I mean, I'm still trying to figure out the efficiency of this 351. I mean, I don't expect some grand study would have done by MidAmerican, but tell me the likelihood that it'll cost more than $350 of time to apply these credits to customer bills. When I'm trying to do my own cost-benefit analysis on such a de minimis amount.
It's not really going to be a credit to the customer's bills. It's going to get reflected in their next monthly fuel adjustment charge. They just be a line item on there that reduces it by that dollar amount.
So does that significantly reduce the burden, the effort? I mean, you're just putting it in there in a big pot with you know, all, you know, dozens of other cost drivers and cost components. But if that's the case, that doesn't sound very burdensome.
Not to me, it doesn't.
Okay.
But I'm not the one making the entries, I guess.
Mid-American, any disagreement with? I mean, you've already said you're comfortable with an August 1 effective date. Is sort of the cost-benefit analysis discussion we're having off base in any way? Right? Doesn't sound like it. Any commission action? I would move that the commission approve the filing with staff's recommendations regarding the update, the cost-benefit analysis, how those costs should be credited to the fuel clause, and with an August 1st effective date. Also, with a staff recommendation, I think I'm changing it with 3 months' notice. Anything I've missed?
This is Megan Early with MidAmerica.
Yeah, Ms. Early, go ahead.
Our response to data request number 4 was that we would agree to submit a cost-benefit analysis similar to the table prepared in our response to data request number 2.
Mm-hmm.
Is that an acceptable format?
It's acceptable to this particular commissioner. Staff, any additional recommendations or thoughts?
It's acceptable, staff also.
Commissioner Colbeck, Commissioner Hansen, any other thoughts?
No. Did you mention an annual report?
I did.
Okay. That was all.
Motion's pending. Any further discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
John Smoltz, aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks very much. Next, we have natural gas item number 1. This is in the matter of filing by MidAmerican for approval of tariff revisions. This is probably the final chapter in this story. MidAmerican?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Melanie Acord with MidAmerican, and we consider this filing to be one of a housekeeping issue where we are requesting cancellation of 2 services that have been expired as of April 30th, 2009, and replaced with a permanent monthly metered transportation program.
Staff comments?
Thank you, Chairman. Just note that the company has requested an effective date of July 15th, and we'd recommend that.
Questions or comments? Hearing none, any action? I would move that the commission approve the tariff revisions with an effective date of July 15th. Any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
John Smoltz, aye. Motion carries 3-0. We're going to skip over the rulemaking and proceed to telecom, where we have a slug of USF dockets. My thought would be we could probably vote on them en masse, but we should pause to see to what extent we have questions on them. Just a reminder to everybody, you know, we can ask our questions in a general way. If we get into information that's been filed confidential, we probably need to move that particular docket to the end. Not that we can't ask the questions. We probably just need to be savvy in how we ask them and how the applicant responds. With that, any questions on any of the USF dockets? I have a question on 33, which is Venture Communications. Again, I'll speak generally, but for 2010, the capital improvement amounts is quite different than in the 2 previous years. And I understand that some projects get shifted from year to year, and I think there was some good explanation of that in the staff data, in responses to staff data requests. But I guess I was a little surprised in 2010 that if other projects got shifted to 2009, that there weren't some projects in the out years that were shifted into 2010. Venture, any response to that?
Good morning. This is Margo Northrup on behalf of Venture. Is Randy Hodak or Randy Olson on the line?
And they may be listening on the Internet and scrambling to get on the telephone line. If that's the case, we can hold that question until the end of this this area.
That was my understanding, that they were going to be on the call. So why don't we push that back to the end?
Sure,
if that's
be fine.
Possible.
Other questions on other USF dockets? On 39, which is Valley Telecom, I was just, and this isn't particularly directly related to the pending docket, but I was just curious about, you know, an RUS loan that didn't come through, if there was some reason for that. Anyone from Valley?
This is Margo Northrup on behalf of Valley. I know that John Tremillion specifically said he would not be able to be on the call today. If there are questions that we weren't able to answer, we would just ask that they be deferred until the next.
Well, and because this question doesn't, it's not going to affect my. It's not going to affect my decision on the DAC, and I'm just always curious to what extent RUS loans are meeting the needs of, you know, South Dakota providers, and so I can certainly get that question offline sometime.
Right. It's my understanding, just briefly, that it's just a timing issue, that they're just waiting for that to go through.
I thought the filing had indicated that they had been turned down, but now we're hearing that perhaps it was just that the grant cycle was sort of out of cycle with this filing. Well, anyway, it doesn't matter much. I mean, certainly I think the rest of the expenditures look in line with what the commission wants to see and what the rules specify. So if we can just get that offline, Ms. Northrup, that'd be great.
I will do that.
Other questions?
Commissioner Johnson?
Yeah, go ahead.
I had one on 49 for Mid-State.
Go ahead.
Actually, I just wanted to be reassured that I know they had some problems completing the money that they expected to spend, but I just wanted some reassurances that everything is in line for the upcoming year to get caught up, and hopefully those upgrades will be made.
Yes, Commissioner Kolbeck, this is Ryan Taylor appearing for Mid-State. I did confirm with Paige Andrew that as certain as they can be midway through the construction season, everything appears to be online for Mid-State Communications.
Okay. There was some plans that had been canceled. I think that everything is back in line with upgrades, not necessarily construction projects, but upgrades to equipment that ECT money is being used for. In other words, you're continuing to expand your switching and other larger capital items. Is that correct?
Yes, it's
okay. That was my question. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? I'll ask one on 44, which is James Valley Wireless. The amount of money received was quite a bit different than what had been estimated, and so I'll ask in a general way, does that come from customer counts that were different than what was expected? Go ahead, sorry.
Commissioner Jim Kramer, I believe that's the reason for that.
Okay, and is that an issue that's expected to continue out in the next, 2 to 5 years, or will there sort of be a reversion back to prior projections? Any thoughts, Mr. Kramer?
Customer counts continue to increase, so I would expect that the projection would meet up with actual in the out years.
Okay. I have a question on 50 as well. This is always a tough one for the commission, and more so on the wireless sort of CMRS providers, but, we have the same situation here, and then when somebody gets USF funds, when they're designated as an ETC, there's an obligation to build out or rather to respond to all reasonable requests within a reasonable time frame. Of course, reasonable is a little bit in the eye of the beholder, but it appears as though with the CLEC, that maybe the build out, the commitment to serving some of those unserved customers isn't maybe quite as aggressive as I might feel comfortable with. Can Mid-State say anything to allay my concerns?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is Ryan Taylor, appearing for Midstate Telecom. In the last year, Midstate Telecom did plan to expand its network. There were a couple things that interfered with that. The area in question, the topography is right next to the Missouri River and is very hilly. So it's important that they have a specific site for placement of their tower. They weren't able to secure the land rights on that, and that interfered with the current year's construction. Then early on in 2009, when the stimulus plan was first announced, they revised plans to try to take advantage of that program. It doesn't appear as that's going to come to fruition, so they are back to plan A on that.
Okay, I'm sorry. So back up. They were counting on some stimulus funds, and now it doesn't look as though those funds will be able to flow to that type of a project?
That is correct.
And so Midstates has made a determination to not apply for those. I mean, those funds haven't been given out right yet. I mean, you know, the NOF has just been released.
Once the rules were announced on how the funds were to be expended, it was not viable.
Okay. Well, and again, this is probably an offline discussion, but I mean, this is about the third time in the last week that I've heard from providers that that NOFA for the stimulus funds isn't flexible enough to allow South Dakota companies to make perfectly reasonable and much needed investments into rural South Dakota. I mean, I'd love to hear offline sometime what was suboptimal about that, so that if there's another round of funding with a new NOFA, that we can make sure that allows, and I'm not making any determination on the project. I feel like it should at least be able to be in the competitive pot. So, Ms. Taylor, if your client can help us figure out, maybe we can carry a message to Congress and the agencies on that. That'd be appreciated.
I'd be very happy to assist you with that.
Okay, so let's get back to, so now you said they're back to plan A. What kind of a timeline does Plan A carry?
Okay. There are two things that will need to happen there, and as I've mentioned, they are in the process of putting up more towers. In order to offer the voice product, it's probably going to need to be a VoIP product. In the last year, they have installed the switches necessary for that, and the testing continues on that project to see that the quality is sufficient to where they would like to deploy it to the public.
So in the next year, did I hear that right?
Hopefully, as the technology matures, yes.
Okay, so at the end of that, and I don't want to pin you down 12 months, so I'll just say, 12 to 18 months or in that relatively short time frame, would it be your expectation, Mr. Taylor, that Midstate would be able to adequately respond to all pending customer request for service?
Well, a significant step has been taken in that they now have a switch available that will support the service. And as they are continuing to test the product, it is going to be dependent on how that the new switch plays out and how the technology that they're attempting to deploy here plays out in the testing.
Well, I understand that there's, technology is a little unpredictable. I mean, you think everything's going to work, but it doesn't always perfectly. There can be delays. But I just don't, I guess what I'm getting at is I don't know the geographic, I don't know the layout of where these customers are. So, I mean, if things work pretty well as Midstate expects, do they anticipate being able to take care of these customers that have requested service in that intermediate, that relatively short time frame? Or do they just know that three of them are so far, out or removed or in a difficult geographic area? I mean, walk me through what the most likely best case scenario is.
In the very rural outlying portions of that exchange, just with the topography of it and shelter belts are a particular problem. If there happens to be a shelter belt in between the tower and the residents, that is a significant problem.
Does that preclude service with this technology?
It would make it difficult, and it probably would entail additional towers.
Okay, I think, you know, next year when Midstate files, I mean, it might be helpful at the same time as they're projecting capital investments, you know, for the next year, if they could give us an idea of what they thought those capital investments would do with regard to filling the unresolved request for service. I mean, if there are 10 outstanding and they say, and the investments next year will take care of 7, I think that helps the commission in a little bit better way understand the progress towards serving the entire exchange area. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does, Commissioner.
Okay. I mean, short of that, then, you know, we're going to want to see a map and where people are dotted. And, again, this is an issue we find more often with the CMRS carriers, but I think as we see, you know, CLEX and RLEX use wireless technologies to try to serve, I mean, maybe it will be an issue that becomes more, affects a multiple or a variety of different kinds of companies. So thanks, Mr. Taylor.
Thank you.
Other questions? Yeah, Ms. Grislov.
Mr. Taylor, this is Greg Grislov. I have a question. Last year there were, there was a larger number of unfilled requests for service. Were those requests filled during the year, or did those people drop their requests, so to speak?
I believe a small number of them were filled. There probably were some who just did not continue in their requests.
So the numbers we have this year don't necessarily mean the requests last year were filled. That's just apparently what's on the books right now.
That is correct.
Okay, that's a great point, Mr. Islav. So, boy, that number, and I think it, I don't know, I don't think that the first four pages were filed confidential, so I think I'm able to say the number of unfulfilled requests was 8 or some number like that, I think I'm remembering. 5, perhaps?
In the current year, 5.
Okay. So then we've got a larger number the year before. I guess another request I'd make to anybody who does this is to give us an idea of the number of unfulfilled requests where we don't have to go back and add and we don't know what to subtract from and we don't know which of those 5 are new or old. I mean, if it could be a cumulative number of outstanding requests rather than just the annual new requests, I think that's more helpful to the commission. Does that make sense, Mr. Taylor, Ms. Northrup, anybody else who has clients that file these?
Understood.
Perfect. Great. Other questions? Great question, Mr. Islam.
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Yeah, go ahead.
I had a similar question as Mr. Rislaw's, but I'm curious on the unfulfilled service request under the present plan. Does Midstate intend to resolve any of the unfulfilled requests over the next year?
Midstate's plan would cover a substantially larger portion of the exchange, and I would have to assume that some of those service requests, probably most of them, would be met under their plans, assuming we can complete the tower construction and deploy the technology successfully.
It's a very small...
I cannot tell you with certainty that all of them would be met by that.
Yeah, I'm not asking about all of them. It's just that since the number appears to be growing, and since the USF fund support seems to be, it's certainly not very much money, I was trying to figure out how you would be able to actually resolve any of the service requests. But you're telling us that you do intend to resolve a substantial number of those?
I think that's a fair statement, Commissioner.
All right. Thank you, Chairman.
Yeah, absolutely, Commissioner. And I know this is difficult, you know, and in fact, in the last year, we've actually had one company, revoke, give up their ETC status because I think of, you know, expectations from the commission that they would be building out at a faster pace than they have. So I know when the amount of money is so small, it can be difficult for companies. They're saying, well, geez, we're getting 2 nickels on this side, and you're asking us to put $1 million out on this side. That's difficult. But I do think we've got, you know, a fiduciary responsibility to try to make sure the rules are lived up to, and the rules do talk about, you know, working to serve the entire area. And so that's what we're, I think that's what we're going to keep focusing on. So anyway, thanks. Other questions on any of the dockets? All right. I don't think we had any that, at least in this commissioner's opinion, any that we probably needed to pull off and not vote on or defer action on. Commissioners, anybody disagree with that?
No, I don't. I'm kind of like you, Commissioner Johnson. I've got a few questions that could probably be talked about offline. They won't sway the way I'd probably my decision.
This is Commissioner Hansen. I agree. I'm a little bit tentative on TC09-050, just on a they're just not quite well, I guess I'll put them on the edge of the table at this point. That I just think we need to have a little better information on them. But I can understand the struggle that a company goes through in the early years. At the same time, that the company really has to show an intent to provide service to, well, throughout the Chamberlain Exchange, and they need to fulfill the service requests. And I'm struggling with it, not enough to pull it off and vote no. I want to see them to successful, but I want to see more from them. So with those comments, I'll make a motion that the commission approve provide certification to the Federal Communications Commission and to the Universal Service Administration Company regarding the plans for federal USF support, and approve each of the dockets.
If we've got a couple of unresolved issues that have been counsel has pointed out to me, so if we could hold that motion and just in advance for just a couple minutes, Commissioner?
That's fine.
The chair is in error. We didn't stop and ask staff for any comments they might have.
Staff would recommend approval on all the dockets. The only one that we were going to mention was TC09050, but I think all the issues have been hashed out.
Thanks, Mr. Thurber. Secondly, we had given Venture an opportunity to maybe gather some information on a question that I had. Ms. Northrup, have we been able to do that?
I was informed that Mr. Hodak's schedule did not permit him to be able to get on the phone, and so either we can defer that or we can have an offline discussion on your concerns in reference to Venture. I'll leave it up to your deference.
Yeah, I think if Venture didn't have such a good history of rather massive capital investments, then I would want to hold it. But I think this is, let me put it this way, I don't have any reason to believe that the 2010, I'll ask you this, Ms. Northrup, just check with your client. If the number that's listed in our filing is what they actually believe their investment would be, then let's have a discussion, you know, at a meeting about that and why that is. It's not going to halt our at least in my opinion, wouldn't halt our action on this today, because I would expect that number in reality is going to be quite a bit bigger in 2010. So, and then finally, Mr. Smith had just, you know, reminded me that somebody could, and again, I'm talking about 50, the Mid-State CLEC, they could fulfill their obligation to serve through resale. Mr. Taylor, is that something that your client has evaluated?
I can discuss that with my client, but to my knowledge, no.
Okay, and certainly for next year's filing, and I mean, now that I think you've got a better idea of the expectations of the commission, your client may want to consider whether or not resale is something that might help them get those number of unfulfilled requests closer to zero. So. All right, Commissioner Hansen, my apologies. You do have a motion pending. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. These are votes on all of the pending dockets. We didn't pull any off, I believe. And so with that, Hansen.
Aye.
Colbeck.
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Those motions carry 3-0. All right. With that, I think we're back to the rulemaking. RM08-002, this deals with the PURPA rules on interconnection and specifically the forms. I'll throw out, I think, how we should attack this. Rather than go company by company to hear their comments, I thought what we would do is go form by form, because I think that will help us structure it a little bit better. Commissioners, any disagreement with that?
That sounds great.
Okay, great. Well, we did also have some general comments. Northwestern, do we have anybody with Northwestern on the line? I didn't think so, with regard to the rulemaking anyway. Okay. Northwestern had some comments on site control. Staff, did you have any concerns with their comments on site control or adding? There is a rule that addresses site control, but as far as the form specifically including more?
No objection from staff in adding the language.
Does it add anything? I mean, the rule's relatively clear. Does it add anything to include more information on the forms? And would that be, I mean, which forms would that be on?
This is Rolaine Wiest. They weren't very clear on actually what forms they wanted it added to, so that was, you know, a question that I would have had for them. And we do have a rule on it, and it says if the applicant is not currently a customer of the public utility, then site control documentation shall be provided with the application. I think that the commission could add, I mean, it's the rule, but we could add that statement to the A form if it was required. Otherwise, I guess the rules seem to imply that otherwise documentation of site control must be available.
Yeah, I have some reticence toward adding, you know, lots of rule language on forms. I think it makes the forms more cumbersome. Now, that being said, if there's a certain ease, administrative ease, of having a line that says, you know, has site control documentation been submitted, check box. I mean, Northwestern wasn't very clear about what they wanted, I guess. So my, in the absence of any further comments from Northwestern, I mean, I guess maybe we should pause. Did that create any concerns for ELPC or Otter Tail, or I think we've got Mid-American on the line as well, or rather Black Hills Power? Does anybody else have an issue with that? I mean, if nobody else got an issue, I guess I would probably say we would not add additional information on site control on the forms. Thoughts? Okay, not hearing anything. So, commissioners, then my thought would be we would take no action on that particular Northwestern Energy comment.
Okay.
Okay.
I thought I heard someone in the background speaking just for a moment there. Was someone trying to say something?
This is Kenna Hagen from Black Hills Power, and I would just agree with Commissioner Johnson's comments that adding additional language might make it more cumbersome if it's not particularly needed at all.
Thanks, Ms. Hagen, and thanks, Commissioner Hanson.
Sure.
Otter Tail Power also had a general comment with regard to attachments on FERC. I don't know, Otter Tail, Mr. Prozic, what sort of forms were you talking about, or what sort of information, rather?
Chair Johnson, Dave Prozic here. I'm waiting for my expert to walk in the next minute, and I hate to put you in a situation to perhaps move us to a different place and for questions. If you can do that, I would appreciate that. Our expert would be able to help us on that question.
Not a problem. I think we might be here for a little while on this, so he or she doesn't have to walk real fast even.
Okay, thank you for that.
Otter Tail also had some general comments. Maybe we'll skip over those generals and move directly to Form 1. Black Hills Power wanted to add some language to Form 1. Ms. Hagen, did you want to address that beyond your written comments?
This is Kenna. No, you know, I think most of Black Hills Power's comments were more corrections or clarifications, so I think they stand on their on their own unless there are particular questions about them.
Okay, great. Did anybody have any, well, staff, did you have any objection or any concern to Black Hills Power wanting to add some language to Form 1?
Staff does not have concerns about Black Hills Power.
Okay. Ottertail also asked for some additional bolded language, and I won't put Mr. Prozick on the spot, but I didn't see a problem with that. Ms. Semler, did you?
No, Commissioner.
Okay. Did either of the commissioners or any other party have any problem with those two sort of cleanup or language changes to Form 1?
This is Commissioner Kovac. You're talking Form 1, Ottertail, and Black Hills Power, correct?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure I was understanding. No, I don't have any trouble with either of those.
If there aren't any objections, maybe we should, you know, unless council tells us differently, maybe we'll just vote on the changes to the form, you know, form by form. If there isn't any objection, I'll just say that the commission will make those changes to Form 1. Any discussion on the pending motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Form 1 is done. Form 2, interconnection facility study agreement. Mr. Prozick, is your issue area expert there yet?
What timing, Chair Johnson? Mr. Dean Pawlowski is here, and I would ask that he would provide some comments as the questions arise.
Sure. Okay, great. And the name again one more time, Mr. Prozick?
Dean Pawlowski.
Oh, that's right. Okay. Okay. Mr. Pawlowski, we're looking, I'll give you just a minute to get your bearings. We're looking at Form 2, the Interconnection Facilities Study Agreement. Ottertail had requested some attached exhibits. Can you give us some more idea of what you're looking for there?
Yes, Chair. The reason for that is just that when we do this through the MISO process, we try to identify a lot of what the scope is so that really both parties truly understand the scope of work and what they will be provided at the end of the day when the study report is written. You know, that's really the scope of what we're trying to do, is just really to, for better awareness of all parties involved, that when they sign and they move into that phase of the work, they understand what they're, what is being asked of them to do and what the other party will be receiving, so they can fully understand, you know, the implications or what results their project are going to have on the system. That's really the general nature, and how we accomplish that is lots of very open to that, but that was the general nature.
Mr. Pawlowski, if we could have you speak just a little slower, maybe a little bit closer to your microphone, we're losing you a little bit.
I apologize. Yeah, what we're trying to do is just make sure that the all parties understand what the facility study will be provided, what is being asked them to study. You know, a lot of these things, the comments we're looking at basically are how the MISO process does it. You know, their own suggestions, but it's good to make sure that all parties understand the scope of work and what they are going to be getting so that everybody has an informed decision to make.
Boy, I'll tell you what, Mr. Pawlowski, it is just, you started breaking up the exact same place. So maybe it's what you're saying and not your technology, I don't know. But if you've got an opportunity to maybe pick up the phone, we can try that last portion again.
Sure.
And I think we understand why you want what you want. I just am not real clear about exactly what you want.
Yeah, I mean exactly, you know, the goal really is to make sure all parties understand what the study is going to give them, what the study is being asked to look at. And, you know, the agreements or the attachments could be very vague or, I mean, just an outline of what needs to be looked at that can be filled in for each study that would be occurring.
Okay, so, I mean, I'm trying to figure out how to work that into verbiage. I mean, you're saying a vague description of what, I just don't know how we say that, because I think it can vary quite a little bit from project to project. You know, of course, we're trying to get some uniformity. So talk me through how you think this looks and reads.
Yeah. You know, I think what we were proposing, and I apologize for not being, was just kind of an outline of, you know, appendices such as study work, scope, the cost of the study. You know, there would be just headings on appendices to describe that can be filled in for each project.
Would this be information that the the utility would include? I mean, they would have estimates on cost studies, right?
Yes, it would be something that the, you know, actually both parties, it would probably be the utility would take the first shot at establishing what that is, and then make sure the customer understands and agrees to the scope of work and the cost of what that study is, so they can are making an informed decision.
And I sort of felt like the rules process sort of already allowed that understanding to take place, but, you know, I suppose attaching other exhibits, you know, probably isn't harmful. I don't know, Ms. Semler, staff, any comments?
Again, as you said, attaching additional information certainly wouldn't be harmful, but just because it's not in required by the rule, too, certainly wouldn't mean that it couldn't be done by the parties and the utility. If they believe that would help facilitate an understanding, couldn't volunteer to add that themselves.
So, and I'm trying to wordsmith just a little bit, Mr. Pulaski, and I know that's dangerous, but is what you're asking for a brief description of studies that would be conducted and cost estimates for those studies?
Yeah, that would be sufficient. Yep.
Is there anything else that you would look to have appended as exhibits other than what I just mentioned?
No, I think that would cover our, what we would be looking or suggest would be a good suggestion.
Does any party, commissioner, or anybody else have any concern with including a sentence like that? That the public utility will attach a brief description of studies and cost estimates for those studies to this agreement. All right. My thought would be that we'd include that that wording somewhere. So unless there's
Kenna
any...
Hagen from,
go ahead.
This is Kenna Hagen from Black Hills Power. Am I getting feedback on our side, but...
Are you getting feedback?
My thought was that...
Go ahead.
My thought... Our only comment is that the language be flexible, so maybe... So if the utilities want to attach addendums or, you know, attachments that provide clarification to the customer, that's their option and maybe isn't mandatory if it doesn't fit in a... that utility's particular practice.
Yeah, now I'm, you know, out of tail after hearing from Black Hills Power, I mean, I'm sort of feeling like we should leave the form as it is, and if we discover as we work through these interconnections that we're not getting the information we need, then we can change the form. But, you know, Mr. Pulaski, now, you know, we're hearing from other affected public utilities that the language you and I are discussing, you know, it isn't necessarily what they'd be a fan of. Would you have great objection to waiting to see how this plays out in reality before making any changes?
No, Chair Johnson, that is fine. I just was trying to make sure that someplace in here that the, at least the customer understood what potential costs were, and if that's fine, we can just see how it plays out and make amendments if they are needed in the future.
Yeah, well, and thanks for making the suggestion. There were also some other out-of-tail suggestions with regarding to including a line about the number of generators, and a clarification on what the word tower means. What do you mean on that? On page 3, you wanted some clarification on the word tower.
Yeah, I guess when we, Chair Johnson, when we read this, we did not know if this meant a transmission tower, distribution tower, wind tower.
Okay. Ms. Somewhere in the insight?
I think it was intended to be a generation tower.
Okay. So perhaps the addition of that word would be helpful. Is generation the right word?
Maybe you want to ask the other utilities if they had any thoughts on it.
Other thoughts? Of course, we're a little bit, I mean, it's interesting, you know, we go through this process for multiple years with dozens of people in a room, and now we get down to wordsmithing some things. We've got about five of us that are trying to figure out what it looks like. So does anybody else have any concerns if, number one, I think either way probably is acceptable. Either leaving a tower number observed in the field, although maybe not exact wording, probably gets the job done. My only concern would be to adding the word generation, is that if for some reason tower is more general for a reason, do we handicap the form by just having the word generation?
Right. I think I would just leave it at power. To the extent that any of the utilities need clarification, I think that we can give that clarification to the utilities. It doesn't necessarily need to be on a form itself.
Any commissioner have an objection to that, leaving the wording as it is?
No.
Okay.
I speak for Commissioner Colbeck, but I do not, no.
Okay, thank you. On page four, Mr. Plosky also asked for some clarification on the word distribution lines. That's on the top line of the fourth page. Any comments?
Yeah, Chair Johnson, what we're trying to understand with this is, again, it's a clarification. When we say distribution lines, when I think of the MISO process, distribution is on the transmission owner side or utility side. And is this asking for utility third-party easements, or are we saying on the generator side, which I'm used to thinking of the interconnection facilities? So I'm just looking for clarification on that. Are we talking on the utility side or on the interconnection customer side for third-party easements?
Okay, so you would insert instead the words interconnection facilities in place of distribution lines.
If we are asking for the interconnection customer, that is correct, Chair.
Ms. Semler, any thoughts?
This section of Form 2 is just, it's data to be provided by the applicant. So it's intended to be on the customer side.
The interconnecting?
Correct.
Okay, so
the language suggestion works.
Okay, perfect. Does anybody have any dispute with that?
I'm sorry, Commissioner Johnson, this is Commissioner Kovac. Could you repeat that?
Yeah, sure. On page four at the top line, currently it says number of third-party easements required for distribution lines. Those last two words would instead be replaced with interconnection facilities.
Okay.
I suppose another alternate change would be for interconnecting, for the requesting. I like interconnection facilities. Good suggestion, Mr. Plosky. Unless anybody's got a change, unless anybody's got an objection, we'll go ahead and just say that change is made to our working Form 2. Okay. Black Hills Power suggested on page 3 deleting ring bus. Does anybody have any objection to that?
No, that sounds reasonable to me.
Okay. Hearing no objection, we'll say that that change has been made. ELPC wanted a clear understanding or more of a notation on the form about the maximum deposit that can be required. They suggested 10,000. I think 1,000 is actually what the rules say. Again, this is another thing where I think the rules make it clear that we don't have to have it. The rules are the rules, but it's probably not harmful either. Any other thoughts from anyone? Staff, you want to leave in or take out?
I would not add the language. I think the rules are what they are, and where do you stop if we want to? I need to take start repeating the rules.
Yeah, right now we've got forms that are pretty short. I mean, this one's, what, you know, 3 pages, I guess 4 pages spilling over. I have a tendency to agree. Does anyone object to not including ELPC suggestions with regard to that additional language? Any commissioner?
No, I don't object. I think it should stay the same.
Okay, hearing no objection, we'll reject that. Instead, move to another request made by ELPC regarding paragraph 5 on the facilities study form. Okay, paragraph 5 of the standard agreement they're talking about. 1, 2, 3. All right, I'm not seeing where they want this change made.
Page 2.
Top of page 2.
Number 5.
Okay, gotcha. That's right. Thanks, Ms. Wiest. They are asking that some language be changed in number 5 at the top of page 2. Specifically, they would strike the first introductory phrase and instead at the end, under the process prescribed in the Commission's rules, ARSD Chapter 201036. Also in number 6, they would make a similar reference to the applicable rule. Does anybody have an objection to that change? Hearing none, we'll, for our working document, say that those have been changed. So to sum up on Form 2, you know, as we sort of work through this collaboratively, I think we've rejected Otter Tail's request with regard to additional exhibits being required. We have accepted Otter Tail's recommendation for new wording on page 3 and 4, section 2, regarding the number of generators. We have declined to add an adjective in front of the word tower, specifically generator. We're not going to do that. We have accepted Black Hills Power's suggestion to delete ring bus on page 3. We have rejected ELPC's suggestion that we are more explicit about the study deposit, the maximum study deposit. And we have accepted ELPC's recommendation or suggestion that we add more specific references to the rules on page 2.
That sounds correct to me.
With that, does anybody have a motion to so approve Form 2?
I'll motion to approve Form 2 as we've discussed.
Okay, motion has been made. Hearing no further discussion, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. All right. Form 3, as we continue to make some sausage here. Otter Tail Power made one suggestion on page 6. With regard to the O&M schedule, Mr. Pulaski, any comments?
Yeah, Chair Johnson, thank you. I mean, when we looked at this, we just felt that the information for O&M scheduling may be a little premature and it may be more appropriate just to get it at the point in time when in an agreement for interconnection is going to be studied. This is, would not be necessarily pertinent information for a study of this nature. So that was the rationale. If the information is needed at some point in time, so if you decide to leave it in here, that would be fine too.
Black Hills Power, you also had similar comments. Do you want to add anything else?
No, we don't have any other comments.
Staff, did you prefer one company's approach to another with regard to these changes? Let me just ask it this way. Does anybody, okay, if the operations and maintenance schedule is a little premature, you know, Otter Tail, do we include this information later in another forum? If not, do we need to, or throughout, the, later in the process? If not, do we need to? If this isn't the optimum place to have this, where is?
Thank you, Chair. I will speak to that. I mean, yeah, I would feel that it's important to have. I would suggest that it be more in the interconnection agreement. I'm not sure, even from the generator side, the customer side, if they will know at this point in time what their schedule would be. So that would probably be something more appropriate in the interconnection agreement phase.
Okay, so you're talking about Form 6 in our shorthand, the interconnection agreement. All right, well, we can take that up in Form 6. I don't want to jump back and forth necessarily.
I guess my
go ahead, Ms. Wiest. Yeah.
This is Rolene Wiest. I guess my question to all the parties would be, people deleted different things. ELPC seemed to suggest maybe deleting all of it. Black Hills Power deleted parts, and I was just, I guess I was kind of leaning toward Black Hills Power's suggested changes. Does anybody have any problems with the deletions that Black Hills Power made and what they actually left in also?
Okay, so for and for anybody who's having a hard time following along, I think with Black Hills, they wanted to delete requirements, add assumptions, and delete specific sections that are duplicative of those things that were included in Form 1.
Right, and they did leave a few sections in also. So that would be my question, whether anybody had any problems with what they took out and what they left in.
Now, Black Hills Power wanted to include operations. I mean, they didn't suggest taking out operations and maintenance. Is that right?
Well, they suggested taking out certain parts of this Form 3. I mean, Section 2.
Okay, do we remember whether or not they wanted O&M out of there?
This is Black Hills. We
they took it out.
Have it deleted.
Operations,
you have it deleted.
Maintenance on page 6.
Okay, good. Perfect. That's
if you look at their comments, they actually have the form and they strike out what they wanted to strike out.
Okay, perfect. Comments. Good. Thanks very much. So for Otter Tail and anybody else on the line, staff, commissioners, to me, it is pretty easy to follow Black Hills Power's suggested form. They did some overstrike, some changes. If we went with that suggestion, does anybody have an objection?
No, I do not.
Chair, we do not have any objections. We just want to make sure the opportunity is available through the process to make sure the correct data is supplied prior to the agreements being signed. Some
sure.
projects have been known to change through the process.
And so perhaps when people are reporting multiple times and it's sort of a moving target, that can be counterproductive. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes.
Okay, gotcha. Well, if there's no objection, then we'll just adopt Black Hills Power's suggestion in there, the form that they marked up. ELPC wanted to add some language to Clause 6. Again, making reference to the rules, I don't think that's a problem. Anyone have an objection to that?
I do not.
Okay.
No.
So with that, then, we're really just making two changes. We're taking Black Hills changes and adding to that a reference in Clause 6, which is on page 2, to the specific site in the rules. Any discussion on – I mean, I'll make that motion to so adopt the revised Form 3. Any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
All right. Motion carries 3-0. No one suggested any changes to Form 4, so let's pause and see if anybody has any new concerns or issues they want to raise. Okay. Hearing none, is there a motion to adopt Form 4?
So move.
Motion has been made. Hearing no discussion, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. All right. Form 5. Otter Tail Power suggested adding some information on page 1 with regard to the facility information, the verification number received by FERC, and again, another reference to the number of generators. Does anybody have an objection to that?
No.
Okay. Black Hills Power had some language changes both on page 1 and page 2. I don't think anything real substantive. Any objection by any party or commissioner? Staff, certainly. Okay. ELPC wanted to strike a question. wanted to strike a question on if it's a qualified facility, have they completed FERC's notice of self-certification? They think that might be confusing. ELPC is not on the line. Does anybody have any objection to that?
No.
Okay. Both Black Hills Power and ELPC raised some concerns with the prime mover question. Any concerns with striking that line?
No.
Okay. So this prime mover type, this is what would normally be included in there? Does anybody want to enlighten me into what that means? Is the prime mover the person who's making the project happen? Oh, the machinery. So why wouldn't that information be helpful?
I think it was just because there were two places where it's asked for. And
okay.
So they're just trying to get rid of it because it's duplicative.
Sure. Remove redundancy. Okay, makes sense. Okay. Does anybody have an objection to taking out that line? Okay. Hearing none, just to recap, we're adopting, I think, all of Ottertail Power's, Black Hills Power's, and ELPC's suggestions for Form 5. Is there a motion to do that?
Motion that we accept all those changes.
Motion has been made. We'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Kolbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. All right, Form 6, which is interconnection agreement. It's a longer document. We've got a few suggestions. So, again, we'll start with Ottertail. Mr. Pawlowski, do you want to talk a little bit? Again, now we're here at attachments. Talk to us about what you'd like to see included.
Thanks, Chair Johnson. Yes. Again, you know, this is an agreement that will be standing for probably, you know, several years, multiple years. We just want feel it's important to have good documentation as to what the agreement is for, you know, what the project is, what the scope of work was for the construction, so that that is documented. So, you know, that's really the intent, is to make sure that we have a good contract, a good agreement in place, so that entities understand what happens if milestones aren't met, or what the milestones are, so that everybody can monitor the progress going forward. You know, some of these projects, even on the distribution, may become a little more complex than just a 40 kW. You know, if it's a small one, you know, they can be basically, you know, not applicable. But if they're larger projects, I think entities may want to know that, you know, where the roles and responsibilities lay. So things such as cost schedule, milestones, description of work being performed, as an outline for appendices may provide value to all parties. So that would be, you know, our suggestion.
For something like the milestones, I mean, do you anticipate that having any legal force? I mean, if it's in the agreement, I mean, is it for informational purposes?
Well, Chair, I guess we'd have to look at the contract or the agreement to say, you know, what happens if they aren't met? I mean, is that not what the agreement is, or are the agreements basically there is no liability there, that it's a good faith estimate? And that would be fine as long as everybody understands that that's what they're for.
Okay, so, but now we've got to have the agreement that we got to change the agreement in each instance to say whether or not the milestones are binding or are not. I'm just trying to make sure the whole goal of the process has been to try to, you know, drive down to, you know, uniformity. Where would you add in this language about whether or not those milestones are binding? Have you given that any thought?
No, I hadn't. You know, it could either be in the body of the agreement or the attachment itself. You know, what we're really trying to do is to protect the generator customer themselves, so they understand when things will be accomplished. If the customers don't feel that would be necessary, and they're willing to deal with a flexible schedule that may be longer than what they anticipate, you know, that is fine with Ottertail.
What do other people think? And Ottertail is requesting, looks like, 5, 6, 7, 8 attachments, contingent facilities, a description of the project, a billing schedule, milestones, scope of work, operational guidelines, and permits. As I read through this, it didn't appear that any of these were unreasonable. I had a little bit of nervousness because we're at the tail end of a process and suggesting some changes that may have ramifications I don't fully understand. Comments from staff, other parties, Ms. Wiest?
I guess one suggestion I would make is that I think the if a consideration could be to say in the agreement itself that the utility or the applicant may request that attachments be included that address and then list these. And for milestones to get, you know, so that's not an issue. We could even say non-binding milestones and list each of these areas and have it at the option of the utility or the applicant whether they want these attachments to be included. Because I don't think the attachments, I looked at the ones that they actually put in citations to I think MISO agreements that had these types of attachments, and my point is they weren't actually, they're just like headings would be the only thing that would be on them. It's not like they're different forms that we would be adopting, and so that would be a suggestion, I guess.
Well, I like the sound of that approach a lot. Any concerns with that? And again, we're talking about making it clear, changing the document so that it says that the option of either party, this information may be required to be attached.
Chair Johnson, you know, I think that sounds very appropriate and amenable to what Ottertail was thinking. Thank you for that suggestion.
Sure.
Black Hills Power would agree.
Okay. Staff?
Yeah. No objection. I think it sounds like a good compromise.
Great. Thanks. Commissioners Hanson, Colbeck, sound good?
I'm fine with that.
Okay. All right, next Ottertail suggestion, we're looking on page 4, section 4.5. They had some verbiage changes. Mr. Plowski, explain why you want on any affected systems stricken.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, we looked at this as saying, as you know, we have engineering data on our system, and we understand our system very well. However, we don't have any engineering data on any other. We may not have data on any other entity system. We also felt that, you know, this language was starting to get where we were the basically the generator's lead on the whole electric grid system, and that we want to make sure that the intention here was not that we would be working with the affected party systems for the generator customer, that we would not be signing any of the contracts on their behalf to get affected systems upgraded. There are, you know, places on the facility where we are on the grid where we may serve a customer, which is our customer, but we're feeding it from another party's line. You know, if for some reason that agreement to upgrade the system or something did not come or was not at the pleasure of one of the parties, we want to make sure that our customers are not harmed by through any potential ramifications of that result. So that was really the, you know, trying to get an understanding of it to making sure our customers would not be harmed through affected systems when we may not fully understand what the affected system is.
So how does this information on other systems get into this process, and whose burden is it to make sure that that information is included or understood?
Thank you, Chair. You know, I would see that, you know, the utility that they're interconnecting with can be the facilitator and help coordinate, you know, the initial contacts to be made with the affected party. That is a challenging thing that would have to be worked through on some of these more complex potential projects.
This is Relaine Wiest. I think maybe I can shorten up this discussion because I was going through these changes again, and I was looking back at the rules, and actually that sentence comes from the rule, so I don't think we can delete it. if you look at Rule 22, it's the exact sentence.
Well, I think you make a pretty good argument, Mr. Pulaski, but running up against the rules is going to be a tough one. So my thought would be we would reject that that suggestion, and if it proves to be overly cumbersome, then the commission would certainly entertain changing the rules at some point down the road. So,
thank you, Chair.
Yeah. Okay, on page 7, Article 6, and insurance. Undertale wants to insert some additional wording. Do you want to explain that quickly?
Sure, Chair Johnson. Thank you for the opportunity again. You know, through some of the other interconnections that we have dealt with, we have found that not all of the developers fully review and understand the rules, and that, you know, actually just putting a simple table of the insurance requirements in here may serve as a benefit to all parties, that it's a quick reference. It, you know, it's not a substantial amount of extra paper, but it would be very easy for them to understand at least this major requirement that they would have to have. So that it's up front with them. So that is the rationale auditor used in making this request.
Okay, so, of course, we've ruled a couple of times already this morning about not reiterating rules in the forms. That being said, I don't want that consistency to be the hobgoblin. If you believe that there are some efficiencies to be gained by including it, I don't know that I disagree. Does anybody object to including that table? Okay.
No.
Ms. Beast?
Looking at the rule again, when it talks about insurance amounts, it says at a minimum in connection with the public utility shall require these. I think it might, we could have something on insurance, but I'm just wondering if it wouldn't be better to directly reference the rule to put them on notice as opposed to trying to put the correct language in.
Yeah, I don't know how your objection or your concern, Ms. Weiss, would just be that it would be adding too much to the existing form?
It was a question of trying to figure out what the rule says, because when it talks about insurance amounts, the first sentence, first three words are at a minimum, they shall require these. And so that's why I thought it'd be beneficial just to cite to the actual rule itself.
Yeah, of course, the table could be prefaced with that same sentence, you know, colon, and then the table, you know, here are the insurance amounts at a minimum, and then there's the table. I don't know that I care a whole lot about this one way or the other. Anybody have any other comments, staff, Black Hills Power, on whether or not to include that table?
I guess staff would just have the same concern with loading up the forms with words, and to keep them as simple as possible. And certainly nothing would prevent the utilities from creating extra information or handouts or forms that they could provide their customers with. I don't know if it necessarily needs to be part of the forms.
Chair okay. Johnson, this is Otter Tail again. And that is fine. We were just trying to, you know, make it very transparent for the customer themselves.
Oh, yeah. No, thanks very much for that. Okay, well, let's... Unless Kolbeck or Hansen object, let's go ahead and, again, in our working document, just add at the end of that sentence a specific reference to the commission rules rather than a general reference. Okay. Black Hills Power made a suggestion for paragraph 1.4, which is on page 2, specifically with regard to the IEEE standard. And rather than tie it to a specific year, they'd want it to add as amended from time to time. As a former legislator, Commissioner Hansen will no doubt know better than the rest of us that is, they don't like that. that's difficult to do, that can be an improper delegation of power. Is that an appropriate understanding, Ms. Wiest?
Yes, a number of the parties had actually recommended this when we were doing our rules to say that, except that we're not allowed, LRC won't allow us to say as amended.
Okay, so unless a commissioner's got an objection, we'll just move past that. Also a suggestion in 2.2, which is on page 3, Black Hills Power wanted to add, at no cost, just to make it clear the utility doesn't have to pay for right-of-way access to access that customer's property. That seems to make sense. Is there any objection from any person or party on that?
No.
Okay. 5.4, which is on page 6, consequential damages, including with the exception of third-party claims, to make it clear that indemnified liabilities included consequential damages. Again, I don't know that that probably is problematic. Any objection to adding that?
No. No problem.
Okay. Paragraph 9.2, which is on page 11, make a correct reference, clean up the reference to 9. I think that's fine. Okay. Moving to comments made by ELPC, they wanted to add some language specifically regarding citing to the rules, which they did sort of throughout these forms. Does anybody have a problem with more explicit citing to the rules, the specific rules, throughout the form?
No, I think they're good.
Okay. I think those are the changes we've got to 6. And then just to reiterate, I think we are making we're adding the language out of Telpower suggested with regard to additional attachments, making it optional for either party. We are including in a number of places more specific sites to the rules. We are rejecting Ottertail's suggestion on 4.5, rejecting Black Hills Power's suggestion in regard to 1.4, accepting Black Hills Power, their other suggestions with regard to wording. So does anybody have a motion that does that, that adopts those changes into Form 6?
I'm sorry, Chairman Johnson, did you mention the Ottertail Power page 7, Article 6 insurance one?
I sort of grouped that in with all of the specific references to rules because
okay.
I think that's the only thing we ended up doing there is just adding the reference to the rules at the end of that section.
Okay. I just went to the – you lost me on that one. But, no, I'm good with all that.
Well, it's good to clarify because, you know, we're moving quickly and, we've got suggestions from 4 or 5 places and trying to incorporate all those. It's good to make sure we know what we're doing. So.
Okay.
Any motion?
Johnson, this is Jim Keck at Black Hills Power.
Yes.
Did you say you included the operation and maintenance schedule language that Ottertail, we said we're going to move it to the discussion to Form 6?
Mr. Keck, great catch. Let's open up that discussion. Does the O&M information need to be included here? Comments by anyone?
Chair Johnson, this is Ottertail. You know, we feel that something probably needs to be in there to make sure that the customer is doing due diligence maintenance on it and that the relays and those things, which, you know, on some of these projects could be, you know, safety hazards, should be maintained. So we feel it's, you know, it's pretty important to make sure that the customer is aware that that is their obligation. They're going to follow the proper maintenance of their facility.
Staff, any objection? Ms. Wiest?
Black Hills would concur.
Just for clarification then, are you just talking about the operations and maintenance schedule language that was on page 6? That was deleted by Black Hills in the prior study?
That's correct.
Okay, I don't see any problems adding that.
Okay, so what we would do is add wording indicate that the schedule has to be attached to the agreement and wording that indicates that the interconnector must adhere to that schedule.
That would be fine.
Are there any, EOPC isn't on the line, are there any concerns that then a, are there any concerns then that a relatively unimportant deviation from the maintenance schedule might put them, cause them to be in violation of the agreement? I suppose from a practical standpoint, what would a public utility stand to gain by that? But
yeah, that is a possibility. Maybe the commission just wants to add in the schedule to the extent that a party wants to say that that was some sort of a default on the agreement. They could always make that argument. But it wouldn't be, you know, then we wouldn't actually specify that any deviation would necessarily be something that would make the agreement go into default.
Other thoughts?
Well, and wouldn't operations and maintenance go towards just creating a dangerous situation? And that is addressed in our rules, too.
So that would be an argument not against including it, but rather than making language to
require it.
Yes.
Be followed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess that makes sense to me to require that it be attached, but to leave silent any discussion on to what extent it needs to be followed exactly. Otter Tail, Black Hills Power, comments?
I would agree.
Otter Tail is in concurrence.
Okay. Well, again, good catch, Mr. Keck. Unless any of the three commissioners disagree with adding that language, then we'll consider that added to our working document.
I don't. This is Commissioner Colbeck.
Okay.
No problem.
Then I will move that we adopt those changes into Form 6. Motion has been made. We'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries. I think that's all the work that we need to take care of on forms. Any other comments, Ms. Wiest?
No. I thought I was just going to mention going back to the general comments. That's right.
Okay. Yeah, let's do that. Otter Tail, did we take care of the general comments that you had? Is there anything we didn't address?
This is Dave Prozick, Chair. I think the general comments were addressed, and I just wanted to make one point that, you know, the discussion that we had did indeed help balance out some of the comments having too few things versus too many. I think we had a really good discussion here, and we are pleased with where the forms are at this time.
Now, specifically, Otter Tail and ELPC wanted an additional agreement for a system impact study. Walk me through anybody. You know, commenter or staff, walk me through what that would look like and if other states use it, if it'd be required. Would that start a new process? Did we take a break, let, you know, staff try to draft a new form and a new agreement?
This is Rolaine Wiest. My recommendation would be that for some reason the forms that we use, the Oregon forms, didn't have this agreement. I think that it should be included. I did find one, a MISL form, that I think that we could adapt, and so my recommendation would be that we adapt that MISL form to a system impact study agreement. The commission will post it, and to the extent anybody has any changes, I think we can just accept changes on that, but still go ahead with all the other forms today.
So would the commission need to, at a future meeting, adopt that form?
Yes.
Okay. Any concerns?
No.
Okay. With that, then we would move to instruct commission staff to develop that agreement form using the MISL version as sort of the template and bring it back for the commissioner for approval. Any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Okay. Anything else? All right. With that, then I would call everyone's attention to the notes and the announcements at the end of the agenda. Is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Motion has been made. We'll proceed to vote. All those in favor of adjournment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, motion carries. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Excuse me. Commissioner Johnson?
Yes.
As long as I have the attention of at least the PUC folks, I would like to take a personal privilege and announce that I have a new grandson as of yesterday at 12:30.
Oh.
Stacy gave birth to a 8-pound, 7-ounce boy. His name is Jonathan Gary Haber.
Oh, my goodness. Grandpa even gets the shout-out.
I love the Jonathan. Jonathan's a good name.
Well, congratulations, Gary, and John and Stacy, and we're all remiss in not asking you about it right away. So
No,
knew you were out for that reason. Congratulations.
That's fine. Thank you very much. Mommy and Grandpa are doing fine.
Well, everybody's, there are about 25 of us still left in the room here. Well, maybe 100, tough to say. But yeah, and thousands on the web. And everybody looks very concerned that the Hansen clan is growing.
Well, thank you. Thank you much. We'll talk to you guys later.
Sounds good. Thanks, Gary.
Yep.